Well, here in the first 25 minutes of Issues Etc., some audio and some open lines. Interesting things the president had to say very recently. And we're also going to be hearing from one of the biographers of Pope Benedict XVI. He has written a biography of the newest pope, and he's commenting on a few very interesting things. In particular, this, well, we've talked about it before on the program, this pope's desire to examine what's going on, what's being taught, and what's happening in Roman Catholic seminaries, in particular in the United States, and the issue of homosexuality in the Roman Catholic priesthood. We'll be hearing that here in the first half hour and getting your responses to it during Open Lines, Issues, etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Then coming up at 4, where are we? Yeah, coming up at, get my sheets in the right order, 3:30 for an hour-long conversation, Deaconess Emily Carter. It's been a while since we talked to her. We're going to be discussing feminist theology and the ordination of women to the pastoral office in that hour-long conversation with Deaconess Emily Carter, followed by another conversation, a continuation of one that was begun on Monday, continued yesterday, and as well here today on Wednesday, part three of our five-part daily series on the writings of Luther during this Reformation month. Today, Luther's writings on monasticism, in particular, a piece that he wrote about monasticism. If you know anything about Luther and the Lutheran Reformation, one thing you may not know is that monasticism, monastic vows, people going and living in convents, big, big issue for Martin Luther, and it plays into the central concerns he had during the Lutheran Reformation. Dr. Martin Nolan will join us then to continue that series during this month of the Reformation. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Before we get started today, I want to thank a faithful listener and friend in Southern Illinois. She treated my producer and I to a very delightful lunch there in my hometown. I want to thank her for the lunch, for everything, and the prayers and the support of all our faithful listeners as well. Well, President Bush has, since September 11th, been very consistent on one issue. Now, he's been consistent on a number of issues, but on one issue he has been remarkably consistent, and that issue is Islam. He has been very careful since September 11th, the terrorist attacks, to distinguish between Islam and terrorism. From, I would say, a week after the terrorist attacks, in public venues, he has drawn a clear line between Islam, he started out by talking about it as a religion of peace, and terrorism. Now, this line has been further emboldened over the last several years. And he has been consistent in his public pronouncements that Islam has nothing to do with terrorism, that terrorism is driven not by Islam as a religion, but by what he has been lately calling a radical ideology. Well, President Bush spoke yesterday at a military spouses luncheon, and he had some things to say about Islam. President Bush says that Muslims have been fighting alongside U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Many people of the Muslim faith are proving their commitment at great personal risk. Everywhere we have engaged the fight against extremism, Muslim allies have stood up and joined the fight.
So he is trying to draw a connection here, and this is true. This is absolutely true. In fact, this is vital for our efforts in both Afghanistan and Iraq. Whatever you think of either of those wars, it's vital for our efforts that the native population aid us in our military goals. And then, as in Iraq, as President Bush is fond of saying lately, the more Iraqis, and he's talking here about Muslims, the more Iraqis stand up, the more we can stand down. So what he said here is true. This is the beginning of his comments. Now, President Bush also says that terrorists aren't true Muslims.
The time has come for all responsible Islamic leaders to join in denouncing an ideology that exploits Islam for political ends and defiles a noble faith.
Now, this is the second time the president has made this statement in about the last 2 weeks. In fact, last time he made it, we brought it to you here on Issues, Etc. And it sparked a question. That question remains. And today it's for you here in the first half hour of Issues Etc. Open lines. If you were president, could you call Islam a noble faith? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Now, I'm not saying that you have to say bad things about Islam. It's not an either-or in this case, but could you refer to, and the president's been consistent here, could you refer to Islam as a noble faith? He uses this term to draw a line between what he views as Islam, the noble faith, and terrorism, the ignoble ideology. So think about that. Give me a call. If you were president, could you call Islam a noble faith? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. President Bush, in this luncheon for military spouses, said that terrorists who kill in the name of Islam must be denounced.
The most vital work will be done within the Islamic world itself. And this work's begun. Many Muslim scholars have publicly condemned terrorism, often citing chapter 5, verse 32 of the Quran, which states that killing an innocent human being is the killing of all humanity, is like killing all humanity.
So the president, this is not the first time he's quoted the Quran, but he apparently has done his homework or had one of his staff do his homework for him so that he is able to say, look, Islam has a basis, and there have been some scholars who have used this basis to denounce terrorism and to draw the line that he is drawing here between Islam and terrorism. It kind of comes down to this. Do you believe that terrorism is an outgrowth of this religion, Islam? Okay, and if you do, and you're president, could you nonetheless call it a noble faith? Or let's say you don't know if there's a connection between Islam and terrorism. You don't know if there's really any causal connection at all. But your president, could even that, could you still call Islam a noble faith? While you're thinking about that, here's another question. If you were president, could you quote the Quran? 505-7850-1-800-730-2727. Now, if you would permit me just a brief response to the president, since he has quoted the Quran and said, look, the Quran would forbid something like terrorism. If you would permit me just a brief response, and that is, you know, there are a lot of faithful Muslims who would say, sure, we affirm that. Taking an innocent life is like killing all of humanity. That's what the Quran says. But we do not consider you innocent. Isn't that the real question? Whether the Muslims that attack us consider us to be innocent? 505-7850-1-800-730-2727. President Bush, speaking at this military spouses luncheon, said that Islamic nations must respect universal human rights.
We're making our case through public diplomacy, stating clearly and confidently our belief in self-determination, in the rule of law, and religious freedom, and equal rights for women, beliefs that are right and true in every land and in every culture.
Now they are, but are they recognized? It is true that in communist China, human rights are human rights. They are right and they are true. Are they recognized? You can go to Iraq, you can go to Saudi Arabia, and you still, as a human being, still have all the rights that are yours by virtue of your humanity, all your basic human rights. Does the government recognize them? No. The issue is not whether or not the rights accrue to human beings. The issue is, does Islam recognize them? It's still a question about this Iraqi constitution. Very happy to see that this thing has passed. But still a question about all of the rights. That is, religious freedom. You know, we count as Americans one of our five basic freedoms. It's all enumerated there in the First Amendment to the Constitution. We have these five basic freedoms. Freedom of religion is one of them. Is that a basic human right? And if so, will it be recognized by Islamic nations? So far, the track record is not good on that issue. So what do you think when President Bush talks about Islam, calls it a noble religion, and quotes the Quran in order to prove that Islam has nothing to do with terrorism and is, in fact, a noble religion? Give us a call now, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's start today with Rod, who calls from his car. Rod, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes, I myself have had the experience of living in an Islamic community in India, which was partially Islamic and partially Hindu, as a Peace Corps volunteer. And I had an Islamic cook. And from my experience, the Islamic religion as a whole is very anti-Christian. And I directly witnessed the situation where a Islamic person turned Christian. He was living with a missionary nearby, and the family of this person was told that they had to totally disown him and even get rid of him. And one night, they heard a loud noise in the other room where he was at. They found the window broken and a lot of blood, and there was no trace of him after that. So the Islamic religion, regardless of what it says, is very anti-Christian, and their laws are very legalistic in quite a few different rituals across the line.
Rod,
so I don't see them as being very empathetic towards the Western culture whatsoever.
So as to the question, Rod, what do you think when President Bush refers to Islam as a noble religion or a noble faith?
Well, I think it's an overgeneralization in the sense that you need to look categorically at the total issue of what the Islamic people believe and how they treat their own people. You know, first of all, in terms of women's rights, there are no women's rights, so to speak. Their vendetta against Christian is historical through the ages, through the centuries.
Rod, thank you for the call. Also, Rod's experience firsthand as a Peace Corps volunteer in India, with political and religious tensions running many different ways in that country, Hindu, Muslim, and Christian. A Muslim who becomes a Christian, bad things happen. You know, this comes down to this question of, and I would seldom go this direction, but how do you find Islam? Is Islam defined by the happy suburban Muslim couple that lives next door to you here in America and go to mosque and send their kids to school and celebrate Ramadan and maybe even invite you over for their Ramadan evening feasts? And they don't like terrorism, and they're good tax-paying citizens and fine neighbors. Is Islam defined by that instance? Or is it defined as what you read in the Quran, apart from any Muslim's observance of it? Or is it defined by the other extreme, which would be the terrorist, who doesn't make a very good neighbor at all? Do you think that the political arena, and I'm contemplating the president's often made statement that Islam is a noble religion, do you think the political arena requires Christians, who may know better, to make statements like Islam is a noble faith, or to quote the Quran, or to say Islam is a religion of peace? The political arena, does it require Christians to make such statements? 505-7850-1-800-730-2727. Bill calls from his car. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, good afternoon. My comment is that actions speak louder than words, and most people remember seeing that videotape when the Taliban was still in power. There was a woman who was caught in adultery or accused of it, She was wearing a blue burqa, and she was kneeling behind a rifleman. And she turned back and looked at him one last time as if to plead for mercy, and he popped her in the back of the neck, and she fell over dead. It broke my heart. I don't recall ever hearing any Islamic nation condemning that action. Again, actions speak louder than words, and Charles Martel, where are you when we need you?
Thank you, Bill. Well, I remember those things, too. And there were the beheadings. And there was this fine line walked by some even Islamic organizations here in the United States, like CARE, where, remember when the beheadings were happening about every 3 weeks? People taken hostage in Iraq right after the war itself was over. And then videotapes coming out of beheadings. And the Islamic group here in the U.S. called CARE condemned, it was a very nuanced condemnation. And many people noticed it. It wasn't just me. It was a condemnation of the beheadings. Because that was not a fit means of execution. But not so much a condemnation of why they happened. It was more like, we don't like the way you went about that. They didn't say that, but that's what it came off sounding like. It was a nuanced kind of a condemnation. And people noticed it and they said, well, are you condemning the terrorism? Or just their tactics? Well, there's a new book out titled Benedict XVI, The Man Who Was Ratzinger. It's written by Michael Rose. He says that Pope Benedict is concerned about reports of immorality in some U.S. seminaries.
Flourishing of what some people call a gay subculture and the deleterious effects that that has on future priests. One of the first ways in which the Pope is addressing this issue is by carrying through with this long-awaited seminary inspection.
We talked about this seminary inspection some time back. There have been op-ed pieces and columns in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch because we have a couple Roman Catholic seminaries here in this area, Thomas Aquinas and Kenrick. And we talked to one of the deans at Kenrick and about this some time back. Well, at the time, it was, well, we need to look at all of what's going on, the whole curriculum, the whole philosophy behind seminary education, Roman Catholic seminaries. Now, according to Michael Rose, the biographer of Pope Benedict XVI, it does have to do with the issue of homosexuality in the priesthood. Michael Rose says that some U.S. Catholic seminaries have become havens for gay activists.
Since the 1960s, there have been those who have made it into positions of authority, be it vocations directors, bishops, seminary rectors, who have either turned a blind eye to the homosexual question or have actively promoted that in some way.
Now, this is the kind of thing, this is the first time I've heard someone publicly say this, beyond just speculation. There's an infrastructure at work in some U.S. Catholic seminaries that is, and it's no secret, tolerant to the point of lenient with homosexuality on campus. This biographer of Pope Benedict says that many of the priests who molested young people, and we're talking about these notorious cases of a couple of years ago, went through the seminaries in the 1970s, and many of them already at that time, if we'd been watching, were something we should have noticed.
If you look at who has been arrested, indicted, and so forth, these are the people who were not accepting of the church's teachings on human sexuality in the seminary and later, and they were part of the so-called gay subculture in an all-male environment.
Not a very healthy mix, really. Even if you're just looking at it beyond, lay aside the whole religious issue, not a healthy mix. Gay subculture, all-male environment, which is the two things that seem to have, that coincide in many U.S. Roman Catholic seminaries. Now, if you can go back and look at the men who had been guilty of priestly molestation and say, even during their seminary days, they disagreed with the church's teaching on sexuality. They disagreed with the church's position on homosexuality. You have to wonder, didn't anyone see the brewing of a perfect storm here? Michael Rose, author of Benedict XVI, The Man Who Was Ratzinger, says an upcoming Vatican ruling on whether gays can become priests could uphold the current standards.
Those who are entering the seminaries cannot be involved in any sort of gay subculture or homosexual relationships, and that celibate homosexual seminarians is okay. The other outcome would be to say that homosexuals, even if they are celibate and plan to be, are really not the kind of men we want in the seminaries in an all-male environment.
Well, the seminaries is one issue, but priests don't stay in seminaries. If all goes well, and I put well in quotations, even the celibate homosexual is going to graduate from the seminary, and he will be placed into a parish or some area of service. And while that environment may not be all male, it does afford him opportunities. A lot of this seems to depend upon the vow of celibacy. Are you willing to hang the future of Roman Catholic parishioners, and I'm thinking particular teenage boys, on whether or not men coming through the seminary who are openly homosexual are going to stick to their vow of celibacy? Coming up after this break, we're going to be talking with Deaconess Emily Carter from male priests engaged in homosexuality to female priests of whatever sexual proclivity. We're going to talk about feminist theology, the ordination of women. Have there been results now that the ordination of women to the pastoral office is commonplace, not a majority view, but commonplace, especially in the West, across all denominational lines, with the exception of just a few? Have there been some effects to women holding the pastoral office? We'll talk with Deaconess Emily Carter about that. Then coming up at 4:30, an hour-long conversation with Dr. Martin Noland of the Concordia Historical Institute. We'll talk with him about the writings of Luther on monasticism. A seminary faithful to God's word in every respect, holding the line not on issues of homosexuality and morality, but also seeing to it that these men are properly trained to preach God's word and administer the sacraments in equal faithfulness in churches all over the country. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Christ-centered, cross-focused training for the pastoral ministry. For more information about them, you can find them at our website, issuesetc.org, or call them 1-800-481-2155.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Are you looking for a helpful resource to teach your child or grandchild the basics of the Christian faith? Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October is really a series of books called Follow and Do. These illustrated books cover the Ten Commandments, the Apostles' Creed, the Lord's Prayer, baptism, the Lord's Supper, and Confession and Forgiveness. You can learn more about the Follow and Do series on our website. That's issuesetc.org. Or by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. It's a catechism for young children with pictures. This series of six books costs $33.99 plus shipping and handling, or you can order the books individually for $6.99. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. Follow and Do. It's our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October. 1-800-325-3040.
Dirty drinking water is a killer. This Global Minute lets you hear what concerned Christians did in India. In rural villages of India, mothers may watch their children die from diarrhea caused by filthy water. They would call it her child's fate, but a man named John knows better. Serving with Action International Ministries, this pastor in India made contact with a ministry called Life Water International to drill new fresh water wells. Here's what happened. In one village, an evangelist and ex-drug addict brought 25 people together to proclaim the gospel. Then the entire village of 400 people wanted to know more about God, while a local team was trained to drill new wells. Pray the Lord will use Pastor John to impact more villages with the gospel, and that many will drink the living water Christ offers. Dip into free mission resources on India through missionvisionnetwork.org. missionvisionnetwork.org.
The Meyer Minute is underwritten by the North St. Louis County Chapter of Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, including Berea Lutheran Church on Diamond Drive and St. Peter Lutheran Church on Trampy Avenue.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute, October 26, 1924. 20,000 people come to see the cornerstone laid for the new Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Wrote one history book, while Francis Pieper, president of the seminary, delivered an address in Latin, an airplane flew overhead. Pieper stopped speaking, so he and the audience could stare skyward and gaze at the spectacle. The irony of that moment, bathed in the language of antiquity and the buzz of modern technology. Second story. An American soldier in Fallujah is watching real-time pictures of an Iraqi village. A drone, an unmanned aircraft, is taking those pictures. The drone is being directed from Las Vegas, Nevada, and its pictures are being studied in Tampa, Florida, in the Pentagon, and in the Gulf country of Qatar. Writes Thomas Friedman, the different analysts around the world are conducting an online chat, how to interpret what was going on and what to do about it. Their conversation is scrolling down the right side of the screen. From old biplanes to today's drones and computer technology, we shut our mouths and think what an exciting time in which we live. And lest you fear, it will be okay as long as we look up, all the way up to the one who oversees it all. I'm Dale Meyer.
Mornings on AM 850 KFUO offer you a Christian way to start your weekday. Hi, I'm Paul Clayton, inviting you to hear your inspirational Christian favorites, great guests, and the information you need to prepare you for the road ahead. And after the morning show at 9:30, stick around for Focus on the Family on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. For the next hour, we're going to be talking about feminist theology, and in particular, focusing a bit on the ordination of women to the pastoral office. Deaconess Emily Carter is our guest. She joins us as a regular guest. She's deaconess at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church and School in Brandon, Mississippi. She's author of an essay titled "Stoles of Suspension: The Mythical Christ and His Attendants at the Altar of the Church." Interesting title. And as time permits, I'd like to talk to Deaconess Carter also about, I think she's got a blog out there someplace, and I cannot remember what it's called for the life of me, although I do visit it on a regular basis. I visit a lot of them, but I know one of them is hers. So we'll talk about that here in the course of this hour-long conversation. Then we'll be talking about Luther's writings on monasticism, in particular one from early in his career, part three of our five-part daily series on the writings of Luther with Dr. Martin Noland. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Deaconess Emily Carter, welcome back.
It's good to be back.
Okay, you're a deaconess. You're a very intelligent woman. I've had several conversations with you on the air and off the air, read many of the things you've written, seem to have a strong theological acumen. Why aren't you a pastor?
That's an interesting question. The reason I'm not a pastor is because I'm a woman, and God does not call females into the office of the holy ministry.
You do understand how that sounds in today's egalitarian culture.
Oh, yes, it sounds horribly sexist, doesn't it?
Is it?
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, it is faithful to His word. It is simply that. God is God, and I am not. And that's simply it.
Is it that, I mean, here we're on a little thin ice, Emily, trying to ask why God says yes or no to anything, but is it because, let's see if we can rule a few things out, is it because women are not spiritually or intellectually or emotionally or theologically suited to be pastors?
Now, wait a second. You just introduced me as someone who is intellectual and has a lot of theological acumen.
Mm-hmm. But maybe not enough.
Oh, wait a second. Now, you and I have gone toe-to-toe and round-to-round on a few things. Have we not?
I think so.
I think so.
It's hard to remember the fights you lose. You tend to end up on your back, unconscious.
So, I mean, that is not, you know, an issue at this point. We have women who are studying at the seminaries. I mean, they are not studying to be pastors. That's true. But they've shown that they have the intellectual capacity. And if you go back and even read, it's been the end of a long day, and the latest CTQ article on the image of God. Oh, Nathan Jastrom.
Yeah.
Who does an incredible job of showing that Eve was created in the image of God, in the image of and likeness of God, and certainly lacked nothing in that sphere, on equality and on the same plane with Adam. So it has nothing to do with being on an equality level. It has to do with, this is what God says.
You say that churches that ordain women to the pastoral office, and I want to come to feminist theology in a few minutes, but churches that ordain women to the pastoral office have to suspend belief. What do you mean by this?
Well, they have to put, well, where I come from is either we take God at his word or we take ourselves at our word. And either God is who he is in according to how he reveals himself in his word, or we are making up our own gods, and we are making up God according to how we think he is. So we have to suspend belief in that sense. In that way, we have to suspend belief and say, okay, I'm not going to believe the God who revealed himself. I'm going to believe the God I make up for myself.
Is this why when you talk about the ordination of women to the pastoral office, you begin by talking about the mythological Christ before you go on to talk about his attendance at the altar of the church?
Absolutely, because when you get into feminist theology, you begin to get into a different Christ.
Who is the Christ of feminist theology, Emily?
He's not the Christ of scriptures. And in fact, she becomes a different person.
She?
Eventually, it becomes a she. And they are quite blatant at saying it could be she. They've been very subtle about it because years ago we had, I don't even know how to pronounce the name, Yeza Krista, used to be you could even find crucifixes. I tried to find one. I thought it would be kind of fun to have one around as an object lesson and say, look, this is what you have when you have the ordination of women, just, you know, to show, do we need this? And you can't even find one anymore. But you can find goddess beads. You know, I do have a set of those just to demonstrate. You know, look, is this what we need? But you can get those. You can order those from a church out in California.
What are goddess beads?
Oh, they're interesting. They're like a rosary. And at the end of it, where normally a crucifix would be, is a little figure of a female. And the prayers that go along with them are, one is even in the in the imitation of the Lord's Prayer. You know, they are rewritten for for, they say, O Mother God, who is within us, we celebrate your many names. Your wisdom come, your will be done, unfolding from the depths within us. Each day you give us all we need and so forth. You know, it just continues on in this type of vein.
I'm a little worried, Emily. You seem to know that goddess prayer a little too well.
I'm reading it
okay.
for you. It was sitting in my drawer beside me in my desk.
You keep it in the drawer in your classroom.
Oh, no, I'm at home.
Okay. I jest.
Yes, you do. But, you know, I it was one of those things that I wanted to say, you know, hold up and say, this was from a Lutheran church in good standing from the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.
The goddess beads and the goddess prayer.
Yes. Yes, it's sold by one of them. This is what goes, what happens, what is not disciplined in a Lutheran church, you know, a synod or an organization that ordains women pastors.
Well, someone at this point, Emily, is going to say, look, we're just talking here about those liberal churches. You mentioned the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, broadly recognized as kind of liberal Lutheranism. We're talking about the Episcopalians, ordained women since 1976. We're talking about the UCC. Who knows how long they've been ordaining women since they became a merged church body. We're not talking, there's no impetus for this in conservative church bodies, is there?
Where did they start? You know, they didn't start there. This is something that started from there. It wasn't in 1970 that they began. It was in 1970 they began as conservative, so-called conservative. And it spread from there until now.
Okay, so you've shown us the end of the road, the goddess prayer, the goddess beads. Jesus is no longer on the cross. Now the mythical Christ of feminist theology is a Christa, not a Christ.
Right. She was there in 1970.
What do you mean?
It was in the 70s that Jesus Christ was actually first brought out. So that now we have come full circle to the goddess beads.
So show us the beginning of the road. Where does it begin, perhaps unnoticed beginnings of feminist theology that could end, and has in so many cases?
The beginning is when we start saying that God's word is not God's word, that God does not reveal himself through his word, but that man finds God on his own.
But these people are only trying to disregard a small section. I mean, what they're really doing is making arguments, some of them plausible, some of them less plausible, against just a few kind of out-of-the-way pronouncements by St. Paul about whether women should be silent in church, whether women ought to exercise authority over men.
But it goes across the board. This is nothing new. This started way back a long time ago. Look at Aaron out in the desert waiting for Moses to come down from the mountain. I mean, the people got antsy and bored with what was going on, said, Moses is never going to come down. Look at all the fire and smoke. He's not going to come down. We've got to have God going before us. So let's go ahead and build our own image of God. So they built a golden calf. That golden calf was not supposed to represent a heathen idol. That golden calf was supposed to represent the one true God. So they built an image of God. God tells us what he looks like, tells us how he is supposed to be worshipped. So they had their first contemporary worship service. And, of course, God let us know how he felt about that, too.
You write, if God is known only by man's tradition and not through his revelation of himself to us, then the face of each society's God changes. And I imagine you could extend that to say that the face of each individual's God changes.
Exactly so. Exactly so. And you can see this through history. When we teach the children history, you know, we do classical education. And you can see how this happens, even from the Tower of Babel, when God confuses the languages and they go scattering about. And you can see, well, what happens next? You know, the kids ask, what happens next? Well, they go out and they go to different parts of the world. What happens next? What happens next? Well, left to their own devices, they come up with their own gods. Is it the one true God? By then, no. No, of course not.
So it happens by little steps.
Exactly. Exactly. It's incremental. It's incremental shifting away, further and further away. But it is certainly not the worship of the one true God.
Deaconess Emily Carter is our guest. We're talking about feminist theology and the ordination of women. She's a deaconess at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church and School in Brandon, Mississippi, author of an essay titled Stoles of Suspension, The Mythological Christ and His Attendants at the Altar of the Church. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Emily, the advocates for women's ordination, whether they're in churches that already do or are still waiting to, will say, look, we are not advocating for a false god. We are just asking that women be granted full service in the church and that they be able to serve at every level of, and all they want to do is serve. How do
and
you
I'm not.
Well, how do you respond?
That's what I say. I'm not. They are serving. How are they not serving? How is Timothy's mother, how did she not serve in the church? This is to deny the vocation that is already given to women. And this is to say, I mean, this is the destruction that feminism has always been, is to blur vocation and to make a vocation something that it is not. To say, this is the thing that Luther had to fight and had such a problem with. It makes the vocation in the church the one vocation that everyone must have. You know, this is where every man a minister is a part of feminism. So that everyone must be a minister and have his own ministry. This is not the true doctrine of teaching of vocation. Every mother who is at home changing her baby's diaper, every Christian mother who is at home changing her baby's diaper, is fulfilling the vocation of a mother and does so as the hands of God. She doesn't have to be a pastor in order to be in service to the church. This is the, you know, when Paul writes about Lois and Eunice teaching Timothy, this is the message that we get from this. Why did they have to be pastors in order to be teaching in the church? They didn't.
So even more foundational than someone coming up with the bright idea of Jesus Christa, or someone thinking, you know, a male savior won't do, even more foundational than that, it sounds as though the problem of feminist theology has to do as much with the first article of the creed, God made them both male and female, as with any other articles of the creed.
Absolutely so. Absolutely. And this is one of the things that, like, Gustav Wingren pointed out, is that when you push the second article of the creed over and against the first article of the creed, it is anti-human. Meaning that, well, he was talking about gospel reductionism at that point, that when you forget who the creator is, there is no object for redemption. And that, again, is what happens with feminism. In order for feminism to survive, you have to rely on evolution and negate all of the first five books of the Bible, because you have to get rid of what Moses says about creation and especially original sin.
Okay, let's take those in order. Are you saying that the account of creation in Genesis establishes something that can't be denied, but is an anathema to feminist theology?
Yes. Yes, it is. Because in the story of creation, once that has been established, that woman comes from man, that man was created first. Why? Because Paul uses that as foundational for why women can't be pastors. That is his first principle that he relies upon. When you go back into Timothy, and Nathan Jastrom is wonderful about pointing this out, that that's the first principle that you build upon. And that women being in the office is the application upon that principle.
So it's practice following doctrine.
Exactly, exactly. What feminist theology has done is made the application the principle. So it's almost like you don't have a conversation anymore, because if you make the application the principle, it destroys the conversation because you don't have the foundation anymore.
Okay, then if this is a, if there's something woven into, implicit in, undeniable in the account of the genuine Genesis account of creation that feminist theology cannot abide, where does the denial of original sin fit in?
Because it was Eve who was deceived. Okay? That's where it starts coming apart for them. They don't want to hear this. Over and again, they hear, this is where Paul comes in again. He says, why can't women come into the office? Because Adam was man was created first, and it was Eve who was deceived. That's his principle. He says, no, we're not doing this. It was man who was created first. Eve was deceived. So let's leave it be.
So feminist theology has to dispense with the basis for Paul's statement.
Exactly. Exactly. So they've got to get rid of Moses. Well, if you get rid of Moses, now you're going to have to start getting rid of Luke's genealogy of Christ. If you get rid of Luke's genealogy of Christ, you're going to have to get rid of Romans 5, well, the first Adam and the last Adam, where sin entered into the world by one man. Well, hello, here we now have sin being pinned on one man now, and sin being taken away from the world by one man. Now we're starting to scratch our head, because now redemption is being taken away from us. And we have this confirmed by feminist after feminist who read, who is it who they read? They read Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And they say, wow, this is a wonderful book because she gets rid of the creation and the fall story. And they're just in love with her because they say, as soon as you get rid of Eve, I am redeemed. So what does that tell us?
So this is why at the end of your goddess beads, there is not a crucifix with a dead man hanging on it, but a little image of a living woman.
A woman. And this is, feminism is inherently, it's feminism, it's a religion that comes out of the earth. It is pagan. It comes, you know, there's, I'm struggling for words at the moment. Patriarchal religions, you know, God coming to man, you know, God revealing himself and giving himself to us. Or every other religion in the world has the earth giving birth to man. And that's feminism. And especially this little image on the one they sent me is just incredible. It's just where the womb would be on a female. is a moon and stars.
Interesting.
Oh, yes. You know, just typical of a female giving birth to the universe or giving birth to light or something. I mean, the imagery is just incredible.
Deaconess Emily Carter is our guest. We are only halfway through our conversation on feminist theology, and we still have a long way to go. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. She's deaconess at Good Shepherd Lutheran School and Church in Brandon, Mississippi, author of an essay titled Stoles of Suspension, The Mythical Christ and His Attendants at the Altar of the Church. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We'll take your phone calls on the other side of the break and continue our conversation with Deaconess Emily Carter. Coming up in, I think it's 11 or 12 days, we're going to be celebrating 10 years of Issues, Etc., our nationally syndicated Sunday night program. A big celebration here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. You are invited. It's an event that you do not want to miss. Well, there are a couple reasons. One, it's 10 years of Issues, Etc. Two, in attendance will be some of the very best guests we have here on the program in person. Your opportunity to meet them and for them to meet you. For more information about the Issues, Etc. 10th Anniversary Banquet, Saturday, November the 5th. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. You will see there a picture of Larry Rast, who will be our keynote speaker that evening. Right next to him, all the information you need. Or to make a reservation, and I surely hope you do, call Jenny Williams, 314-505-7836, 314-505-7836. There are only 80 seats left remaining. We can only go up to 200, then we have to cut it off. And time is running out. 314-505-7836. That's Jenny's number. It's $50 a plate. We're celebrating 10 years of Issues, Etc. When we come back from this break, we continue our conversation on feminist theology and the ordination of women to the pastoral office. A question after our phone calls, a question for Deaconess Carter, the role of culture. What is really driving all of this? And then Dr. Martin Nolan will join us in 25 minutes for an hour-long conversation on the writings of Luther. Today, the subject is monasticism. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues, Etc., please visit the audio archive section at kfuo.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.